This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Voting trends for 2020. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for joining us. Here's what's coming up this hour. More young people say they plan to vote in next year's primaries compared to 4 years ago. Here are the results of a new survey. Also, a number of dress code violations at our schools these days aren't coming from students. They're coming from parents. Plus, looking for a safe investment with steady growth? Find out why liquor is a better haven than food right now. And the feel-good college sport these days? Gymnastics.
Well, what was really exciting was to see a bunch of the gymnasts who had either won Olympic medals, narrowly missed out on the Olympic team, or generally had elite careers, now competing several years later in their retirement, effectively, in the NCAA.
Wall Street Journal reporter Louise Radnofsky on the new mood at the NCAA Gymnastics Championships. She's here later in the hour. Well, more young people, especially those who identify as Democrats, say they plan to vote in the 2020 presidential caucuses and primaries than did 4 years ago. According to a new Harvard University Institute of Politics poll, here to break it down is Amar Madhani, national political correspondent at USA Today. Amar, what are we learning?
It's sort of a continuation of what we saw at the midterms. Young voters, that 18 to 29 demographic, are saying at this point at least that they're more interested in the upcoming 2020 elections than they were at the same time 4 years ago. Pretty significant, though the jolt upwards is notable for Democrats. It's slightly down for young Republican voters, but we're looking at about 43% of young voters overall surveyed that say that they want to take part in the caucuses and primaries in early 2020, and that compares to about 36% at the same time 4 years ago.
Interesting. And did they give a reason why, or was it just kind of like the one or two question survey?
Well, it was. It got into several questions on issues that young voters might be interested in, but I think there's an anxiety motivated largely by that.
What I thought was also of note was that it seemed that environmental issues or environmental-related issues were at the top, not so much, hey, get rid of my college debt, for example, or get me some free college.
Right, right, which is something that Elizabeth Warren talked about yesterday on announcing her plan to sweep away student loan debt for about 75% of Americans. But yeah, near the top of the list is the environment. And these young voters, they see this as a foreign policy issue that, you know, it next to, you know, terrorism and human rights, that they see participating and protecting the environment as being one of the most important goals of U.S. foreign policy.
We're speaking with Amar Madhani, national political correspondent at USA Today, and he's written a piece entitled "More Young People Likely to Vote in 2020 than 2016. This is according to a new poll from Harvard University. You know, I thought it's worth asking, too. They want to vote in 2020. Does that necessarily mean they will vote in 2020?
No, it's always more people saying they want to vote and that they intend to vote than actually show up. Right now, we have 43% saying they plan to take part in the primaries and caucuses, but it'll inevitably be much lower. Similarly, you know, it was quote-unquote historic, the midterm elections, when we saw just 31% roughly of young voters show up, and that was a 25-year high. So it could very well, much like the midterms, end up being a higher portion of the electorate being young, but at the end of the day, it'll remain awfully low for the overall number of young voters, and older voters will inevitably remain the larger part of the overall electorate.
Eventually, this Generation Z will have some pretty good sway right, when they step into these polling places. What'd you say,
1 in 10
voters at some point?
Yeah, that's right as of January or February when the Iowa caucuses start, 1 in 10 of the electorate will be between 18 and 23.
And with regards to primaries and caucuses, how might that voter enthusiasm match up against general election? Or is it a good sign, say, that the numbers are improving for a primary because you're more likely to vote in a general? I don't know that that's the case.
Right. Well, yeah, I think it's a good signal. If we get good turnout of voters in general, but particularly of young voters in the primary, the expectation is that it'll be even higher for the general election, because a good segment of our society, young, middle-aged, and old, just don't identify with the political parties and don't necessarily want to have a part in that, in choosing the party's candidates to face off in the general election.
How much of that, by the way, is part of that one stat which talked about, and I forget what it says specifically, but how younger voters don't really see baby boomers as representing their best interests?
Well, that's, I think there is, as this poll shows, there is the sense that their interests and their concerns aren't being represented by this older set of politicians. And it might explain, to a certain extent, the sudden rise of a millennial like Pete Buttigieg, who's gone from hardly registering in the polls to now being a top 3 or 4 candidate.
Thanks, Amar. Amar Madhani, national political correspondent at USA Today. You could argue that U.S. stocks are reasonably priced, with the S&P 500 companies trading at roughly 22 times their reported earnings for the past 12 months. That's not much above the 50-year average of 19.3, and hardly outrageous given today's modest bond yields. But you could also argue that U.S. shares are horribly overpriced. Here to explain is personal finance expert Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, what have you done here?
So one of the things that I do with HumbleDollar.com every year is I update all the statistics in what I call the market section, which looks at long-run stock market returns, specifically what's happened over the past 50 years. And if you look initially at stock returns over the past 50 years, there seems to be a very sort of neat and tidy story that we can tell. Over the past 50 years, nominal GDP growth has been about 6.5% a year. This is GDP growth over and above, with inflation included.
Yeah.
And then you look at corporate profits, those have also grown about 6.5% a year, and lo and behold, share prices have risen 6.5% a year. So you look at it and you say, yep, the economy grew, corporate profits grew, stock prices grew, all by the same amount. It seems like it's a direct link between them. And yet, when you dig into the numbers, the story is far messier than it seems.
All right, so what are those numbers? What do you mean?
When you start to think about corporate profits in the past 50 years, yes, you know, they've risen at about the same rate as economic growth, but arguably they should have grown even faster. And there are two reasons. One is we've seen a huge cut in the corporate tax rate over the past 50 years. You go back to the late 1960s, and the top corporate tax rate was over 58%. Today, it's 21%. As a consequence of that cut in the corporate tax rate, we should have seen corporate profits growing faster than the economy. Second, we've seen a widening of corporate profit margins. There's a lot of discussion in the press about income inequality, and this is the flip side of income inequality. Even as wages have been held down, the mirror of that is that corporate profits have been taking a bigger chunk of GDP. So as a consequence, we should have seen corporate profits grow faster than the economic growth rate, and yet they didn't. And the reason is something called dilution. And dilution is simply all the time companies are issuing new shares, all the time new companies are emerging. So if you're a current shareholder, your claim on the economy's profits is gradually diluted over time. And so essentially, this cut in the corporate tax rate over the past 50 years, this widening of corporate profit margins, has offset this very insidious effect of dilution, which tends to take profits away from existing shareholders.
Mm. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece entitled On the Other Hand, as he's taking a deep look at stocks. So what does this mean for us as investors then?
So as investors, there are some reasons for optimism and reasons for concern. The reasons for concern is that, one, the corporate tax cut, cut in corporate taxes could be reversed. That would have a bad effect on stock prices. Second, the share of GDP going towards corporate profits could go back to the historic norm. Today it's over 9%. Historically it's been about 6.5%. So again, we could see that back off. On the other hand, there is also good news in the numbers. This dilution that I've been talking about has actually pretty much disappeared over the last 10 years. Companies have been buying back a whole lot more of their stock than they have historically. And as a consequence, shareholders are not seeing their claim on the economy's profits diluted by this big increase in shares and by these new companies emerging. So it's sort of a good news, bad news story. Looking forward, probably the biggest concern if you're an investor is whether we're going to get slower economic growth. We had great economic growth in 2018. One of the key components of economic growth is growth in the labor force. Historically, we've seen the labor force grow at about 1.5% a year. Looking ahead over the next 10 years, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is saying that the labor force is only going to grow at 0.6% a year, so almost just a third of what we've seen historically. And that means that we will likely see slower economic growth, and that could mean slow growth in corporate profits, and that in turn could hurt stock market performance.
Good. But generally speaking, as you point out at the end of your story, stocks you still find are the best bet long term?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can worry about economic growth being slower. We can worry about the rich valuations that we see in the stock market right now. We can worry about the low dividend yields on stocks. But the fact is, stocks still seem like the best long-run bet, particularly when you look at the 10-year Treasury note, which is only yielding around 2.5%. If you say to yourself, you know, buy stocks, will I earn more than 2.5% a year over the next 10 years? It would be pretty shocking if you didn't do better than that.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. The most popular milk worldwide comes out of goats. The United States, where cow is queen, is an outlier. But new data shows even in America, dairy goats are having a moment. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
America's new pastime? Apparently, it's milking goats. Laura Riley of The Washington Post has written about the popularity of goat milk and joins us now. Laura, I was surprised to see that the rest of the world already knows about goat milk. Why do we drink cow's milk?
It's one of those mysteries. No, it's true. In most parts of the world, goat milk is the number one consumed milk, oftentimes in the form of cheese and other kinds of food products, not necessarily chug-a-lug. And we've just, for decades, been cow-based. And I think we've seen a real shift in this most recent agricultural census, partly because of all of the kind of the stuff in the news about lactose intolerance, I think, is really at the root of some of this. And parents are rethinking how much cow's milk they're feeding their kids.
So what is the difference between cow's milk and goat milk when it comes to lactose and anything else?
Well, goat's milk is lower in lactose. It's not lactose-free, but it is lower. And the fat globules are slightly smaller and easier to digest. So people who have digestive issues associated with cow's milk often will turn to an Alterna milk, you know, whether that's the milks with a Y, the, you know, almond, oat, soy, or a different animal milk.
Laura, what does, I don't know how you could answer this, what does goat milk taste like?
It's a little tangier. I think that if you've had goat's milk cheese, there's a teeny bit more kind of muskiness to it and same with sheep. You know, it's a little bit more flavorful milk. They're a little bit harder. First of all, goats are much less productive than a cow. You know, you have to kind of milk 10 goats to equal the milk of one cow. So it's a very different kind of quantity we're talking about. And a lot of the, you know, I think in the early 1980s, when goat's milk cheese was a novelty kind of specialty item, it was much more of a hobbyist's adventure. And we're now starting to see some much larger scale goat farms in this country.
We're speaking with Laura Riley of The Washington Post. Laura, talk a little bit about the goat population. How does that compare to cows?
Oh, we're still dominated by cows, absolutely. And, you know, it's been a rough few years for cow dairy in that even though there is still a lot of milk out there, prices have really been depressed and input costs are high. So a lot of dairy farmers are closing up shop or selling out to bigger farms. So we've seen a lot of movement in cow dairy recently, but it's been interesting to see this incremental growth in goat's milk. And what's interesting to me is also it's very dominated by women. You know, 90-something percent of the goat's farms out there are have a woman at the helm. So it's kind of a one area of ag that has a real gender skew in this in an unpredictable direction.
Why do we think that is?
Well, you know, anecdotally, a lot of the people we spoke with said, well, goats are smaller. They're easier for a smaller person to handle. They tend to be closer to the house. So if you talk about kind of a more traditional gender role situation, a woman, you know, if she's more a farm woman who's more, you know, centered in the home, would have an easier access to those animals kind of adjacent to the home as opposed to way out on the range. And I think because it's so connected with making cheese, I mean, it's much less oriented towards drinking, you know, just a big glass of it, there's a culinary component to it. So a lot of the real grand dames of goat cheese, you know, they kind of were culinarians before they were goat raisers.
Laura, if you wanted to drink straight goat's milk, where could you find it? And what about the price compared to cow's milk?
Well, it's definitely going to be more expensive, significantly more expensive, and that's because the production takes a lot more. So you're going to find 2-3x the price, maybe even more. And it's same with cheese. The cheese is, by and large, a more expensive product.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Laura Riley, reporter at The Washington Post. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
I'm not a big talker. I am a big doer. But sometimes the only way to solve the problem is to get on the horn and figure it out. So the only people I like talking to? Grainger. With knowledgeable product experts, ready with the answers to my toughest questions, Colin Grainger is the one conversation I don't mind having. From machining and motor parts to valves and vacuum pumps, when it comes to solving my problems, Grainger's got my back. Call, click Grainger.com, or stop by to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're a small business owner, and there's nothing small about what you do. That's why Dell Small Business Technology Advisors give you trusted advice, one-on-one partnership, and tailored tech solutions, like computers with Intel Core processors, servers, storage, networking, plus thousands of top-brand electronics, accessories, and software. No matter your technology needs, Dell is here to help your small business do big things. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
A school in Houston is clamping down on inappropriate dress, not by students, but their parents, joining a handful of schools across the country that are banning short dresses, sleepwear, and other items that parents sometimes wear into school buildings. It's a story by Wall Street Journal education reporter Tonell Hobbs. Tonell, what's going on?
Well, you know, we've got this situation in Houston where a parent was turned away from enrolling her daughter. The parent had on a headscarf and a dress that was considered too short, so she couldn't enroll her. You know, I remember the days when, you know, school administrators, it wasn't unheard of for them to pull a parent to the side and say, hey, you know, can you dress more appropriately? But what's going on now, as we're seeing at the Houston School and a few others, is it's become a more formal. They're putting it in codes of conduct and letter. They are coming up with parent dress codes.
Wow. So is this something that's enforceable, or you're just expected to respect what the school has put out? How does that work?
What I could see right now, it's enforceable. I called the Houston School District for comment, and they didn't want to comment. So, and my question was, I obviously wondered if eventually the child was enrolled and the school district wouldn't even answer that because of privacy matters. But from what I can see, you know, they've been pretty enforceable.
I hate to even ask, but like, how inappropriate is some of the dressing that we're seeing?
Well, in this case with the mother in Houston, she had a t-shirt. It was like a Marilyn Monroe t-shirt that she was wearing as a dress. And, you know, they just said it was just way too short. Mm. And, I mean, you can't go in there with a shower cap, hair rollers, pajamas, sagging pants. I mean, it covers a lot.
Jeez. What has this has been a problem that's been going on for some time, or is this fairly new? Do we know?
I've covered education for a while, and I've always heard administrators complain or just, you know, rather seriously or jokingly about what a parent came up wearing. I mean, for a while there, we had some principals that didn't like the mom showing up through the dropout lane in pajamas. So that was a thing.
Yeah. Wow. We're speaking with Tonell Hobbs, Wall Street Journal education reporter. She's written a piece entitled Schools Add a New Section of the Dress Code for Parents. The students in these schools, I assume, have some sort of dress code, too?
Yes. I mean, these are schools that, you know, most schools do have dress codes. But it's almost like carrying the dress code from the students to the parents. And in some of the codes I've seen, it says dress code for students, dress code for parents. So they're kind of continuing it, you know, starting with the kid, and here's how we expect you to dress as a parent.
Wow. So to back this up maybe a little bit, is there any idea how we got to this point where schools actually have to guide parents on how to dress appropriately?
That's a great question. I mean, because this story is getting a lot of chatter because it is a good discussion point. The principals, I've talked to a couple that they seem pretty fed up with it. And their concern is that it's not okay and they don't want the parent in the school because kids think, oh, it's okay. Or in the case I talked to a Tennessee state rep who was pushing a bill that would require, you know, such things as a code of conduct that could include a dress code. And he had talked to a principal, and the principal had told him that he had a mother that visited an elementary school in a negligee.
Oh, my goodness.
And that apparently there were body parts exposed. Oh. I've heard over the years just so many different stories, and some of the principals are just wanting to get it in right and get it more formalized, and that's what we're seeing.
And I mean, what could the penalty be other than just turning them away, right, and asking them to come back more covered up, I guess?
Yes, it's turning them away, but, you know, to some parents, you know, that if you want to be involved in your child's school, you know, just like this case with this mom, she couldn't enroll her daughter. And so obviously she was upset about that, but, you know, they will not let you in that school. They will not let you on that campus.
I saw a quote in your story at the tail end, which said from the ACU, these parent dress codes perpetuate sexist norms. What did it mean by that? Do you know?
Their fear is that when you look at, you know, they're saying there could be some concerns under the federal Title IX law because that females have a different standard, males have a different standard, and, you know, if you're female, you're expected, they want you to dress a certain way, and they're setting that standard, and they don't think that that's right.
Thanks, Tonell. It's Wall Street Journal education reporter Tonell Hobbs. This, by the way, prompted a very funny exchange of messages on Twitter with regards to inappropriate dress, but it included teachers. Some guys were recounting their stories from, say, high school or college. If you want to see them, you could follow me on Twitter with the username @GordonDeal. Glad you're with us. As much as we enjoy kicking failures when they're down, we also love redemption. Boston Consulting recently studied 11 companies it dubbed Comeback Kids and found investors disproportionately reward turnaround success stories. Tiger Woods has enjoyed the turnaround. Will Boeing go through the same thing if and when it fixes the software on 737 MAX jets? Here's Wall Street Journal business columnist John Stoll. John, what got you thinking about this?
President Trump had tweeted about Boeing. Okay, so Boeing's the company in the penalty box right now for a very serious situation with their planes, the 737 MAX. He's suggesting, look, why don't you ditch the name, make the plane better, and rebrand it. And I think a lot of people look at that and say, okay, there might be some business logic there. But if you look at what happened with Tiger Woods, I think a lot of people, you know, for good reason, thought, this guy's done. He's washed up. We need to move on. And, you know, there were some companies that stuck by him, stuck by the name, and continued to invest in him. And he really delivered on Sunday on that investment, basically the investing in the comeback. And the moral there is, you know, a company like Nike, and this is adjacent to Boeing, a company like Nike had so much invested in Tiger. They had created a logo much like the Air Jordan logo, and really to give up on that investment was was something that they just did not see as a good idea in 2009. And yes, it took a long time for that to pay off.
Yeah.
But just look at the fruits of that patience and that wisdom that they had as a company to stick with them.
You brought up the great cyclist Lance Armstrong in your story, too. Nike right. gave up on him. What made the two different?
Right. And I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think that, you know, what Nike said at the time was that Lance had deceived people at the core of his talents, meaning his product was not legit. You know, nobody questioned whether Tiger Woods was legitimately winning golf matches in the 90s and 2000s. Lance Armstrong was winning by ill-gotten means, and that was reason to drop him because his brand would never come back, and that was the calculation they needed to make.
So with regards to Boeing, when somebody says change the name, do they mean change the name of the 737 MAX or Boeing more broadly?
Yeah, I don't think it's the suggestion that you would rename Boeing. Boeing is so big and they have tentacles in so many different sectors,
yeah.
including defense. 737 MAX, anybody who flies a lot, you know, or is into aviation knows this name. I mean, it's the workhorse for them. It's kind of the Toyota Camry for the airline industry, and I think the suggestion here is let's kind of put this chapter behind us and rename it Dream Cruiser or something.
Mm.
And, you know, every case is different. I noticed in my column, like, you can't just say you'd never give up on a brand. I mean, if your brand name is, if you're a perfume named Isis, which there was a perfume named Isis, at some point you got to throw in the towel and say, you know, our brand name is just, we can't bring it back
yeah.
from where people associate
yeah.
it with. But it's far more common to see companies invest in a brand, figure out how to make it cool again, or relevant again, or meaningful again, and reap the rewards. Investors will reward them very richly, disproportionately richly, if they go out there and do that kind of work.
Thanks, John. It's Wall Street Journal business columnist John Stoll.
This human resources professional is a rock star, thanks to Kronos. And this is her hype song.
I'm the spark before the fire. I'm the power in the train. I
have HR, payroll, talent, and time.
I'm the dream, and you should know that.
Now we're engaging all the best people.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
Women's gymnastics fans have long talked of the NCAA as the place where elites go to be happy, especially in the sport's post-Nasser period. At the NCAA championships in Fort Worth, Texas recently, that seemed truer than ever. Wall Street Journal reporter Louise Radnofsky says the mood is noticeably improved. Louise, what did you see?
Well, what was really exciting was to see a bunch of the gymnasts who had either won Olympic medals, narrowly missed out on the Olympic team, or generally had elite careers, now competing several years later in their retirement, effectively, in the NCAA. And what struck me in particular, having covered a lot of this gymnastics over the last few years, was how different athletes looked when they were competing in college, and the key difference, they looked really happy.
Because oddly enough, right, with perhaps it's gymnastics, women's gymnastics in particular, they're past their prime, right, in most people's eyes.
Yeah, it depends what you mean by prime, because they are certainly not competing the most difficult skills that they were when they were 16 and at the Olympics. But as one of them put it, the difference for her with the NCAA was that she really learned how to dance, and her dancing is significantly better than it was, as is her level of enjoyment for the sport.
It was actually one of her rivals, right? Like an opponent who said that, who complimented like her
yes.
improved dance skills, right? That's great.
Exactly. A lot of these girls go back years, as they say, to when they were competing against each other for a spot on the national team. And now they're still competing against each other in some cases, for different colleges. In other cases, they're matched up on college teams with their former competitors. But they all say that the difference and part of what makes it fun is they really do feel a sense of teamwork competing for a school as opposed to when they were competing for the U.S.
That was very telling, because there was one young woman you talked to who said the NCAA championship, which was won by Oklahoma, was better than a lot better than the world championship.
Absolutely. And that was Maggie Nichols, who was on the 2015 world team. The other thing about Maggie Nichols and many of these athletes is that they were all caught up in one of the just the worst scandals to affect their sport in years. They were victims, in many cases, self-identified victims of the team physician Larry Nassar. In Maggie Nichols' case, she was the first athlete really to raise concerns about his treatment at USA Gymnastics. So they went through a time that would have been tough by any standards competing, with this additional difficulty and stress. And now, really, in college, they're finally getting this rock star treatment. It was striking to see how excited Oklahoman Boomer Sooner fans were to see these girls competing.
All right, so you've covered enough of these things. Like, you actually recognize, like, a noticeable mood difference here.
There's a lot of differences. There's a mood difference that most of the athletes, when they're describing what they're doing in NCAA, start by using the word fun, and they use that in direct comparison to their experiences competing in elite gymnastics.
That's a good word to use with regards to school sports, or school and sports. Wall Street Journal reporter Louise Radnofsky, glad you're with us. Investors should think about stocking up on liquor. The Wall Street Journal says companies that sell whiskey and cognac have many of the defensive qualities once associated with big-name kitchen and bathroom brands. Remy Cointreau, which makes Louis VIII cognac as well as its namesake labels, Wednesday reported 7% sales growth for the first 3 months of the year. Last week, Jameson Irish Whiskey's owner Pernod Ricard said its sales were up 6% over the 9 months through March. Household brand owners Nestle, Unilever, Procter & Gamble also had a good start to 2019. P&G reported 5% quarterly sales growth. But these companies, which used to routinely grow at that rate or faster, now face stiff competition. Their old reputation as a safe bet for investors has taken a hit. The Journal says liquor may be a better haven these days. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.